baby good bunny.
Hey, welcome. You've dialed up Taking It Down, the preeminent pop culture podcast from the Alabama Take. We hope that you're all doing well and avoiding sickness. Reach out to us. Let us know how you're doing and what you've been doing to kill some time. Today on the show, we got a lot. We're going to be covering odds and ends, but the main focus of our show is going to be the Michael Jordan documentary that's currently airing on ESPN called The Last Dance. We're going to talk about the new HBO show Run, the finale of Devs that recently wrapped over on Hulu. Some very brief thoughts on MTV's The Challenge, and like I said, some odds and ends about music and television sprinkled throughout. We've consumed a lot, so we're going to talk about it in just a second. Joining me today, of course, as always, is co-host Adam Morrow. We'll get into the show in just a second. All right, Adam's with me.
Good to be here.
Good to be anywhere, isn't it?
It is. I was going to add to your introduction that if you're not doing well, if you have it, let us know. What is that like? I want to know.
I do too, and I don't mean that flippantly.
I don't either. I've had one friend that is in, you know, a younger age bracket. She's 32, 33, mm-hmm. that's had it, and she got sick on Saturday, and by the next weekend, she was in the hospital. So I know that there is a spectrum of response to this, but yeah, in these days when some people say, no, it's overblown, yeah, it's still bopping around, especially she lives in Chattanooga. That's not too far away from Alabama Take territory.
Right. Have you heard from her since she's been hospitalized?
She's just been a couple days in. She's back out now, making a recovery.
Still scary stuff, though.
I didn't mean to start us off on a downer note there, just an addendum to your introduction.
Mm-mm. No, I'm glad you did, because I am interested in how this affects. It's kind of like that thing where, you know, you and I both lived through the Tuscaloosa tornado of 2011, and for weeks afterward, I would go online and watch videos of that tornado from all these different angles and try to figure out what I could do next time. So I guess it's kind of a similar thing mentally.
Yeah, just a fascination with, it's not even like a, at least for the tornado, it wasn't like a grief component. It's just like, what the hell just happened to us, and trying to understand it in that way. Yeah, absolutely.
And be prepared for the next one if there ever was one, I think.
Yeah, yeah. On to some happier news. This was a wonderful week in media, I thought.
Yes, I do too. I really do. And we're going to touch on a ton of that stuff. But before we do anything, because I didn't last week, I want to touch on, let's cue the music. Let's hear about the Morrow Movie Marathon.
Well, so Blaine's laughing right before we started recording. I called my wife, Natalie, in the next room on the phone. She didn't answer.
Phone called. Yeah.
I phone called. Well, I've got the door closed and we've got dogs. And so it's a whole thing of getting them settled. But so I had to walk out there and we collectively tried to remember what movies we've watched lately. Time is just like, I don't know what it is anymore. I don't have any demarcation lines going on. I'm just like lost in the soup of time, really.
It's a construct anyway.
Yeah, it's, yeah, absolutely. Never more so than now. But she reminded me that we have watched a few pretty good films. Maybe the most recent one being Lighthouse, you know, that came out. It may technically have come out 2018. I don't know if it came out at the tail end, but really made the rounds last year. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, never came to the Shoals, but it's an A24 picture. It's got a, let me get my full rundown here.
That's a William Dafoe and Robert Pattinson black and white film.
That's right.
Yeah.
It is. And I want to make sure either I get my director, what else he's done. I feel like he's the guy that
done
did
the
witch, right?
Yeah, he's the guy who did the witch. And I can't think of his name.
Robert Eggers. But this was very much in the vein of, did you see The Witch?
I saw The Witch and loved it.
It's so good. Let me ask you this. Did you watch The Witch with subtitles on?
No, I watched it in the theater, and I've only seen it the one time.
Oh, okay. So I watched it with friend of the show, I guess we can call him that, Hayden Crawford.
Sure.
And he recommended, he had seen it before, he's a big fan, he said, let's watch it with the subtitles, I feel like we'll both get more out of it.
Interesting.
Because they speak in that, I don't, would that be Middle English? Definitely Colonial English. I don't know what the official academic term would be, but
I think it's just, it would be, it's modern English. I think it's colonial. It's just antiquated a little.
But a lot of it flies kind of fast. I say all that to say, when this guy, Eggers, does something, he's not doing it by halves. You know, like you were fully in that kind of pilgrim Massachusetts, New England world. And he returns to that world in a more modern sense, definitely a sense of New England dread in the lighthouse. And I have a fascination. My friends kind of poke fun at me with, like if I'm bored late at night by myself, I'll get on YouTube and watch big wave videos. Like there's something that kind of disturbing, but also comforting about giant waves.
I didn't know this about you, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't tell everybody until I say it on a podcast that literally anybody can listen to. So when I heard about The Lighthouse, I was like, oh, they shot this in this archaic black and white film format. It's got two actors who could have guessed when Twilight was out, I would count one of its stars as, you know, going forward, somebody that, oh yeah, I'll see something he's in. He's good.
And the new Batman.
Could be great.
Yeah, he's the new Batman. So yeah, Robert Pattinson. So, yeah. So give me a rating here, and then give me a general reason why, because I haven't seen it, so I don't want too much spoiled for me. Though I know the gist of the story.
If I was to give it a B+, I would say that a second viewing or even more time thinking about it would push it into A- territory.
Are you a strict grader?
What is that? What do you mean by that?
Like, are you pretty harsh with your grades? Like, it's hard to earn.
It's hard to earn a straight up A. Yeah, okay. For sure. I think because it's one of those that's not at times fun to watch, but it's just so well done. The acting's really good. Things fall apart and you start questioning things that you've seen. It's really good without giving too much away. And you know, it never, spoiler alert, nothing really ever happens besides these two guys walking around this rock in the middle of the ocean where a lighthouse is. I mean, things happen within that setting, but it's almost like a play kind of thing where, I mean, there are elements you couldn't do in a play. They talked about how miserable they were filming this, you know, having to walk because of this archaic film that they shot it on. It's like the lighting could be difficult. And if a lot of it is, you know, them pushing wheelbarrows in a monsoon, basically, or a hurricane. So there's a lot of, I don't know, very gritty, very literary. I really enjoyed it.
Well, good. And you got, you guys have taken in some more movies, right, in your movie marathon.
We have. The other one that I have neglected to mention is Loving Vincent, which is a film from, I think, 2017, based on the late days of the great Vincent Van Gogh, and the whole thing, it's kind of claim to fame. There's two movies about Vincent Van Gogh that have come out recently. One with Willem Dafoe, actually, that is fantastic.
And this isn't the Willem Dafoe.
This isn't that one. Okay. It's still very good, but the whole thing was done in animation with oil paintings.
Oh, so no, I have heard of this one.
It took a giant team of artists to create this story, you know, I mean, to illustrate it, you can imagine how much work goes into a feature film length animation in oil painting. Wow. But the premise is that there is an undelivered letter that Van Gogh meant to send to his brother Theo that just never made it. And after his death, the postmaster in the town that he died in, or I'm sorry, that he spent time in, ask his son to go on this journey to deliver to Theo, but Theo died shortly after his brother Vincent, so there was no one to deliver the piece of mail to, and this young character ends up trying to figure out what really happened in Van Gogh's last days. That's always been kind of up for speculation. Did, you know, famously mentally unstable, in and out of institutions, cut his ear off, and then eventually killed himself is the conventional story, but this kind of looks at some of the other evidence and circumstances that say maybe that's not the whole story. Mm-hmm. I should say that digging in, most experts say, no, he killed himself. But it's still an interesting movie.
And your rating?
I think maybe just because I had seen the Willem Dafoe movie, which is called, I believe, At Eternity's Gate.
Okay.
That one, I would give an A. This one, B plus.
Okay.
Somewhere pretty good. Pretty good. If you're looking for a shift in format, it's aesthetically pleasing to watch for sure, and a pretty compelling story. And they even referenced unnamed people in his paintings they kind of cast as extras, mm-hmm. and had them fleshed out. It was interesting.
Did the aesthetic appeal, did it ever get old, though?
There were times that I was maybe more interested in the story, but I also got lost in it. Like, I just kind of forgot that, you know, sometimes with a novelty format like that, it's just overbearing, I think, is maybe what you're getting at. But it never really felt that way to me.
Yeah, that's a pretty high concept, artsy-fartsy way of making a movie.
Yeah, but the story ends up being very linear and not simple, but, you know, there's an A, a B, and then a C. Like, everything is... It doesn't get too convoluted in that way.
Good to know. And I think you got another one, another movie you have to talk
this
about.
This one, Natalie yelled at me as I was walking back in. She said, tell them that we watched... I feel like everybody has already seen this, but we put it off when it came out, 7 Days in Hell. We finally just kind of broke and we're like, well, enough with this high drama stuff. Let's watch something funny. And it's the HBO, it's like a probably 40-minute long mockumentary about it, kind of based on a famous Wimbledon match that just refused to end, the Isner-Mahut. Because, you know, in tennis, if you get to the fifth set, you can just, especially Wimbledon specifically, you can play forever. You have to win by two. Mm-hmm. There is no tiebreak. So, like, theoretically, there could be an infinite game. And this one kind of is a take on that has Andy Samberg and Kit Harington
right.
as the opposing players. And I don't know. You know, you just hit a certain point when you're quarantined that you need, like, some good scrotum humor and Andy Samberg flailing around. And so if you haven't seen that and you've got 40 minutes, I know that we rep HBO a lot on this program.
We really do.
But dig that one up on HBO. You will feel better after watching that.
It's 7 days in hell, and it's really only 40 minutes?
It's 40 minutes. And they convinced people, like, you know, Serena Williams is in it. All these tennis talking heads are in it, and they're all pretty funny. It's good.
It's also got Will Forte, Fred Armisen, Lena Dunham,
yep.
a few others
yep.
like that in there.
Yeah. The Fred Armisen plays a very stodgy, like, Wimbledon official
mm-hmm.
who's kind of like, you know, Andy Samberg's character is the bad boy of tennis, kind of a mixture of Andre Agassi and McEnroe and all these. And McEnroe's in it, and of course is hilarious because he's always hilarious.
Yes, he is.
But yeah, he plays that, and they kind of use the Fred Armisen character to contextualize why he's being ridiculous. It's very good.
So, and that brings me, I just want to bring this up briefly, and then I want to get to your rating on 7 Days in Hell. But
oh, A plus.
Okay.
Comedic 40 minutes couldn't have been better spent on Saturday night.
There's
a depressing point. I mean, I know that we're naturally introverted and would rather probably watch TV on Saturday night, but you're sitting there like, well, what am I going to do this weekend? You're like, well, the same old shit that we've been doing this whole week. So we needed that pick me up on Saturday night.
So there is the John McEnroe thing reminded me of this. I'll just plug it quick. It might be something we look at in the future. But
are you going to talk about the Mr. Deeds reboot?
No, I'm not.
Not that Adam Sandler movie that he's in. Yeah, never mind. I'm falling down a McEnroe rabbit hole here. Go ahead.
Well, no, here's the thing. Mindy Kaling is coming out with a new show where it's a teen. Never Have I Ever, I think it's called. It's coming out on Hulu or Netflix. I'll have to double check.
Oh, I've seen this.
So
an ad went by and I said, well, everything that she does is, she's funny. I like her. So
she's funny, but not only that, but McEnroe narrates it.
I'm in.
Yeah.
100% in.
And it may be coming out like later this week or next week. It's pretty soon. So we might circle back around to that in a future episode. But that's Mindy Kaling. All right. So the Morrow Movie Marathon. We'll kill the music. Kill the music, people. There's something I wanted to talk to you about that we've been talking about off mic, and that's you. it's something you probably wouldn't have mentioned on your own, but you front and sort of have huge control over two bands right now, and you're also involved in music otherwise. We know that. Listeners know that. But one of your bands is Della Ray, which you and your wife front and write for and then create. And you've recently completed an album all at home, right?
Yeah. We started it. It was funny because, I mean, I'm sitting in the room that we record in, and we ended up with her dad's drum set. He was still is a drummer, but this old Ludwig kit that he'd had since the 70s was, I think, just taking up space in the attic. And he'd said, do y'all want it for a long time? And we finally rearranged stuff in the house until we could get it. And then once we had the drum kit, it was kind of on after that. I guess I should say because Natalie was still at work at this point. At the very beginning of March, kind of set a goal. My birthday is in early April. I thought, I'm going to take this basically month leading up to my birthday. I don't have a lot. I was supposed to go to South By. That was really like the only big chunk of time that I was going to be gone and try to write and record a record in that just as a challenge. And then it just happened to spill over into what we're in now, this actual quarantine.
Do you have a release date set for it?
We do. We submitted all our stuff over the weekend. Singles are going to start coming out in the next. Again, I'm trying to reconstruct time here. About 10 days from now, the first single is going to come out. And then there will be one single a week until the whole record comes out on May 29th.
Maybe we can squeeze in a snippet of the first single here.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I've listened to probably, 3/5 of the album?
Yeah, something like that.
I think I listened to about 3. And I was impressed. I thought it was good. I liked it a lot. I really wish you guys could get it on vinyl.
It's so expensive.
I know. But it's good.
In a year where like nobody knows, well, really, most musicians I know are resigned to the fact that we're not going to tour again until next year.
Mm-hmm.
Like musicians are probably the group that's taking, you know, a few experts have come out and said there won't be mass gatherings again until fall of 2021.
Wow.
Every musician I know, full-time musician, was just like, yeah, okay, I don't know what we're going to do, but that is the reality that people are preparing for. So, but all that to say, like, you sell vinyl on the road. It wouldn't be very cost effective to just print the amount that I feel like we could sell from home. I don't know. Maybe it's something we'll look at. Who knows what this whole landscape's going to look like?
Well, that's one of the things that's happened to me is I've gotten so into vinyl during this time off because I've had time to actually just sit with vinyl and just sit in a different room and, you know, create that space away from my wife and kid because they need it away from me. And,
right.
And yeah, I've gotten so back into vinyl. And I started collecting more. Yeah,
people who are on salary at a stable job have been very. I feel like we talked about this when this all first started happening, and I was kind of giving that wrap up about how musicians are reacting. People in that position who still have money coming in have been very responsive to help and support, and people are getting creative. Like a shout out to Bo Hicks at Druid City Brewing who. Is paying artists to stream on the Druid City social medias. And he got that through some very clever maneuvering to get local and state backing. So I mean, there's a pretty cool network out there that's developing, and I think, you know, we're only a month into this, really. Hopefully that just continues to develop.
That's right. It's a good time to buy some vinyl or CDs or t-shirts from your favorite artist, I would say.
Yeah, buy it direct from their website or buy it from a little label.
Mm-hmm. But I do have a question, and I didn't want to get into it with you on text message because I felt like you couldn't have explained. So I saved it for this podcast because I think there might be other people who are interested in this. I'm just fascinated by the idea that you played all the instruments. How in the hell do you track something like that? I mean, I know how it's done, but how do you make sure you're in the same time signature? Do you use a metronome of sorts or whatever? I remember the first time I'd heard about anybody doing this, I was back in probably 94, getting into music really like heavily around that point, if I wasn't already. But I heard of Jay Maskus kind of doing this on a few tracks for that Dinosaur Jr. album, Where You Been? And since then, it amazed me. I thought, how do you play all the instruments?
You know, when we do stuff, say the studio that we work at a lot, Portside Sound, if we're in there for Del Rey or Speckled Bird, which Speckled Bird actually has our first single coming out soon too, as well.
Okay.
So that'll be something to look out for. But usually I wouldn't play drums and then play everything else after that. So I guess my brain, I mean, Hayden would play bass a lot, but since he's been gone to Seattle, my brain is, you kind of, it's like a muscle that you develop to think about how different pieces are going to fit together. And I feel like doing the whole thing, just like the nuts and bolts of it, I would sit and I used to do this as an exercise, just find some like riff or something that I thought was interesting, immediately write it down. And I'm sitting here looking at two legal pads where I would just write things down and cut all the fat and try to only get interesting parts, which, I mean, it should always be the goal, but not, you know how it is writing a song where you kind of, if you feel too attached to the whole thing, you can't think objectively and edit properly. Mm-hmm. So sit there and put it all on the page immediately, not even lyrics yet, just song structure. And before lyrics, before anything else, record like an acoustic track or an electric track or whatever. And then it was all to a click track, like you're saying, a metronome. Mm-hmm. And I would run and do the drum part, and then I would do the bass. And, you know, I'd usually try to do all of that in one sitting, more or less, if I could. And then if the bass made the drums, because I'm not a drummer, for sure. But I was just trying to do parts that fit. And then so doing the bass, if that, like, tied together the rhythm section, then I would step back and then, you know, move forward from there. And if it didn't, then I would try the drums again.
You almost have to think about the song as a whole when you do that, right? Like, you have to know loosely what kind of drum sound you want or rhythm that you would want, or you
know. Sure.
I can't do that. That's why I think I find it so fascinating, is when I used to write songs, I just wrote a song. I didn't think this would be a good place for blah, 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 or whatever.
Right. A lot of the time on these, the lyrics came last, which is not something that I had done a lot. Usually it's like there's a group of folks and I'll take, you know, what you could play on an acoustic guitar to people, and then we'd kind of cobble something together. But this one, I don't know if that makes for a stronger song, or doing it this way makes for a more compelling, because like everything, you can't just rely on like, well, I feel like I really capture something in the lyrics there. You know what I mean? Because you don't know if you have or not. So putting little hooks and interesting textures and all that kind of stuff all the way through is the challenge.
It all sounds very challenging to me. So that's Della Rey's new album coming out. What was the date on that?
I want to say the 29th. Let me make sure that's right. Yep, the 29th.
And that's just the first thing, or are you going to drop the whole thing?
The whole thing comes out May 29th, and the first single, barring any distribution errors, will come out on the 30th. We have another one out on Cinco de Mayo. Mayo for the linguist out there. On May 11th, we have another one, and on the 21st, another one. So basically one a week until it comes out, the whole thing, on Friday, the 29th of May.
All right, cool. And if you're listening to this point, you have heard some of that first single already in the podcast. That takes me to another album that's getting a lot of chatter online. It's Fiona Apple, her new album.
It's a perfect record, so they say.
Well, you said you liked it a lot, and I was wondering if you could comment on what you hear when and what is it that you like about it.
I think her... I'll say that if you haven't read, there's a New Yorker profile on her that came out in late March that is so, so, so good. I feel like that particular brand of music journalism, and I know we kind of rag on places like Pitchfork at times, but, you know, a writer who's really keyed in on doing that kind of old school, go to the celebrity musician's house and kind of walk a mile in their shoes and try to understand context for a record. I still love that writing so mm-hmm. much when it's done well. I mean, this New Yorker piece was fantastic and set the stage to me for what came out. Cause it's been a while since her last record. It described kind of the writer talks about friends and colleagues when they said that they're going to go interview Fiona Apple, like, the first response is she okay? You know, people have this like vision of her as this kind of unstable, wild person, which is, you know, she hasn't worked to dissuade from our minds really, but she's really just a recluse living in California now, it seems like. And they talked about the construction of the songs, her, all this percussion sitting around the house, and she was just had a couple microphones and GarageBand making a lot of this, which is pretty amazing for someone of her stature. You know, you think if she could record anywhere she wanted to, but I don't know. I think some of her, I can't call any to mind right now, but just the way that she presents her lyrics, the way that she frames it with the music, I don't know. I was just really impressed by the whole thing. I don't know how anybody can say it's a perfect record after only spending a few days with it. Maybe those reviewers got to spend more time, but I listened on Friday, and then I thought about it for a while, and I didn't listen to it over the weekend except a few singles here or there. I feel like that's going to be one that is so omnipresent for a while that I'm just going to kind of live with it and figure it out.
You're the second person to mention the New Yorker profile on her. Caleb Johnson was telling me about that, and he was commenting on how good the writing, I think, was and how it made him much more excited for the album. The album is Fetch the Bolt called Bolt Cutters, which is just that's a great album title coming from an artist. I think that may not be that great at titling her albums. That's just my opinion. That she had that weird, crazy one in like 2012 or something. But that opening track.
Great title.
You think so? Oh, no, for this one.
This one's a fantastic title, yeah.
That opening track, I Want You to Love Me, I felt really strong. And then I think Under the Table and Shamika were also two that I felt were really good. I think that the album is very powerful. Here's why I would probably not serve well as a music critic, I think, is I could hear how it was great, and I wouldn't argue against anyone who felt like that was maybe their favorite album even ever. But it's still not for me. I think that the parts of her writing, I find there's a playfulness with melody, I think, that I find a little disarming and just not my cup of tea per se. But
it does feel very both melodically and in arrangement kind of deconstructed in mm-hmm. a way that I totally get if that's not somebody's bag. It's definitely not. Or maybe in a time where, you know, rap and beats and all these things have been cooked into our culture for decades. It's more palatable. I don't know. Just there are moments, like I said, where it's just percussion, like things kind of tinging and bopping and she's singing over it and it's kind of melodic, but it's kind of not. I get how that's not for everybody.
Mm-hmm. I think a good example of that is that final track on I Go. I think that was just lacking something, but I will say that I'm really enthralled by the thematic nature of it as an examination and a stand against patriarchy and how that stifles females over the years. There's a lot of that running throughout all of the tracks, and those it's pretty good. And like I said, if somebody came to me and said that was their favorite album of the year or maybe even ever, I wouldn't blink. I would think that would make sense.
It's going to be tough to dislodge this one, just if you're talking objectively, artistically, from being the best thing this year. I mean, I know we're only in April, and who knows what this quarantine will produce, but, you know, I feel good about saying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty good. It's good. Not all of it's my cup of tea, but I do see the greatness of it. We're going to shift gears pretty drastically here.
Undeniable greatness is on deck if we're going where I think you're going.
If there's a through line to this conversation, now we're getting into some undeniable greatness here. It really undeniable. You can't deny it. If you deny it, you're an idiot. We're talking Michael Jordan and the documentary that aired last night. The first two parts of it aired last night. We're recording on Monday. The Last Dance. I felt like everyone in America was watching this.
There was something deeply therapeutic about that too. Like what has unified the country for the last month and a half? Terror, mm-hmm. fear, anxiety. And I went to bed and was just like thinking about 90s NBA, you know, and slept peacefully. It was so good. It was so good.
That 80s and 90s NBA with Ahmad Rashad doing that Saturday morning show. That was just the epitome of my 12-year-old, 13-year-old self.
Yeah, this was, as being younger, I guess, he was already, you know, I mean, like Space Jam was aimed at me in terms of like the age group. So he was already, there was no ascension. He was already the guy, you know, and has been since then. I don't know. Seeing like the Bulls merchandise and seeing all that stuff just made you remember how fully saturated that was. And like, you think like, oh, Kobe, oh, LeBron. And this is not like a basketball discussion. I'm just talking about for a kid in elementary school and middle school in Alabama still to be that in awe of that whole thing.
And I'll, full disclosure, I hated Jordan. Hated Jordan. Just hated.
He's a hateable guy.
Maybe so. Maybe to some. I didn't hate him because of his personality at all. I never thought about his personality that much. But what I hated was just how damn good he was. I enjoy a workmanlike excellence, like Nick Saban comes to mind, where you know there's work involved, and he was just a natural. Not to say he didn't work, because the documentary, especially part one last night, proved that he worked his ass off.
When Kobe passed away, there mm-hmm. was a great, great article, I believe it was on The Ringer, and it noted, it kind of trying to wrap up why people did or didn't like Kobe. And they said, with Jordan, he hid all of the brushstrokes. You know, if he's painting this grand masterpiece, he was just always on, always a genius. You didn't see him stay late in the gym, shooting jumpers, all this kind of thing. With Kobe, he was like a kid showing their work in math class, you know, and covering the page with it. And he got the right answer, but there was no question that he had just worked harder than everybody else in the gym. And there's a, which is true with Jordan as well, but he kind of hid that away. There was much more image control. Interesting contrast, and interesting to see maybe the behind the scenes of, you know, obviously, you know, that's not true about Jordan, that he didn't work, that he was just, like you said, it appears that he's just showing up and being the greatest to ever do it. But mm-hmm. a lot went just on behind natural. The scenes too. Yeah.
And that's what this documentary helps to expose, is that, yeah, he was working his ass off.
So, and I think what do you make of the format? There was maybe 10 minutes in, I was thinking, are they really going to spend 10 episodes on that last season, the 97-98 season? Because I hadn't read anything about it. I mean, I knew that they would have to go back, but it's like being in a Faulkner novel, man. They're like in 97-98, and then they zoom back, and now they're in Pippen's timeline, and that works so well for me.
Yes, it did. It did for me too. And I picked up on it like you. A lot of this stuff that I know I'm going to watch, I try to avoid reading anything about until I've watched some of it. And you're right. That's what it did to me. I thought, there's no way they can just, why are they starting at the 97 season? And sports documentaries, if they're done well, to me, will remind me of things I'd forgotten or tell me things I didn't know behind the scenes.
Absolutely. It's telling that this guy, the director, is the one who did the Allen Iverson documentary. And apparently he's done a lot of stuff, but when Jordan went to meet with him, I was reading this last night, and he's looking at this big wall of like credits that this guy has. And he saw that in the corner and he said, "You did the Iverson documentary?" I said, "Yeah, that was me." And you don't think of Michael Jordan and Allen Iverson as,
peers maybe.
Yeah, they have that weird, you know, Iverson very much belongs to early 2000s and Jordan 90s, even though they would have played against each other. But Iverson didn't fit. Like, Jordan is very palatable to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, like, white America is okay with Jordan because he, you know, anything that was unsavory was not seen. He had a nice haircut, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Didn't wear what they would have considered offensive clothes at the time. Iverson didn't give a shit at mm-hmm. all, you know, mm-hmm. what you thought about him. And so it was endearing to me that Jordan told the director, whose name I'm blanking on, said, "You did that." He said, "Yeah, that was my thing." He said, I saw that three times and I cried every time. Hmm. And shook his hand and said, "Let's do this."
Jordan may be easy to cry though.
Could be. He kind of, he's a little soft. If anything, that 2 hours proved he's a little soft.
Yeah. No, that's of course referencing the meme of him crying, of course.
Yeah.
So what do you think makes a good sports documentary? Do you think playing with the timeline helps? I mean, it obviously helps this one, but what makes a good sports documentary? Because I've been watching a few more lately, it seems. The 30 for 30 have aired on ESPN because they don't have many sports to cover or at all. So what do you think?
What are some of the 30 for 30s that stand out to you?
Well, I watched the Christian Laettner one, and I thought that was good. Again, that late 80s, 90s basketball, it really fills a void for me. I loved basketball then, and I'm back into basketball now a lot. Our era, I think, is just as good, but that 80s and 90s.
It's a different brand of basketball.
It's great, though. It is. 100% different. But to me, a good sports documentary tells me, first of all, they get the interviews of everybody involved. That's huge.
Yeah.
And the second thing I think they do is what I mentioned earlier, is they dive into things I had no idea happened.
Yeah. Like, I as a kid, definitely did not understand the nuances of, say, the Scottie Pippen situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just thought that these were all millionaire aliens. You know, what's the difference in getting paid less than somebody else who's making an extraordinary amount of money? Yeah, all the little nuances like that, all that backstory. I think grounding it I know this is kind of a trope at this point, but, you know, I want to see where they came from. I mean, Scottie Pippen's Arkansas humble beginnings, you know, this is one of the greatest NBA players of all time, and he was the equipment manager before he could get on a college team.
And that blew my mind. He's got such an amazing life story.
It's easy to try to avoid sports cliches as like motivation, but like when you hear somebody say that and you see the life that he created for himself, that is inspirational. Obviously, we're not going to like all go start doing wind sprints or whatever, but anytime you see the human condition or humanity prevail like that, it kind of, you know, you got to be kind of dead inside not to be inspired.
No, I felt it. I felt exactly what you're talking about. I remember thinking last night in the Scottie Pippen portion of part two, I was thinking, I'm going to get back into running tomorrow.
Yeah.
and I haven't.
It'll make you run a little harder, work out a little, or do whatever you do with a little more. I think that's like the Saban effect, right? If you are kind of just an Alabama fan, you become a student of how he handles the program and conducts his business and demands excellence and, you know, it breaks that down into just handling what's directly in front of you. Mm-hmm. And not worrying all the time about the big picture. Like, these are like actual, that's just good life advice. That's not just like how to win a football game kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of these great sports documentaries do that. They make them human. They tie it to both like an upbringing kind of culture, like Jordan talking about experiencing racism and saying he wanted to get basically somewhere. He didn't put it in these words, but like unassailable, you know, he went both like geographically. And I took that to mean if you are in his like childhood mind, like if I'm the greatest basketball player, then maybe these things won't apply to me anymore. But part of that is growing up in the 60s and then being an adult in the 90s. I can't imagine many generations experiencing more difference from childhood to adulthood than folks in his position. But I think about like probably the last great sports doc that I watched was the Diego Maradona one that's on HBO. You probably know the name Pele. Most people aren't as familiar maybe in America with Maradona, is possibly because, I mean, he was kind of the bad boy of soccer, but the undisputed greatest at the time. He's a tiny little guy and just would clown all these people. He had the famous Hand of God game against, I can't remember if that was England. That was England. In the Mexican-hosted World Cup, got involved in all sorts of shady dealings in the 90s in Italy with like the mafia and drugs and all this stuff. But the whole time it's tying it to what it means for him to be, you know, from Argentina, what it meant to represent that country, what it meant to his club in Italy. You know, it ties it to a time and a place. And I think that's a really powerful thing, especially as like Alabama fans, we understand. I mean, obviously not all our listeners will be, but you understand maybe how much of an impact that has. I don't know. I feel like they're getting there with Chicago, kind of tracing it from this losing organization into, you know, I mean, them walking through Paris, they said the Beatles like five times. I mean, that's the only other response that I could, or a group that would cause that kind of response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And him walking with that beret was so damn cool.
Oh, man. He really was. And he was cool. And I despised him because I was a Celtics fan. And I despised him because you couldn't do anything to stop this guy. You could not double team him. You couldn't do, this was back when man on man defense was a rule in the NBA, and you could double team someone, but you couldn't play zone. And I just hated him for his greatness. Much like I'm, you know, people hate the University of Alabama for their football greatness, and you know, the Yankees for theirs, though they come about theirs a little bit more questionable. So anyway, it's going to be a great documentary. I'm sure we'll mention it again. And we're talking about, here's the worst segue ever. Are you ready for it?
this could be rough. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's going to be rough. It's going to be stilted. So we were talking about getting back into, I was talking about getting back into running. HBO now has a show called Run. No, HBO's new show, Run, is where we're going next. It's written by Vicki Jones, who is Phoebe Waller-Bridge's writing and creative partner, from what I understand about her. But I saw it described on a website. Apologies that I'm forgetting. It's a rom-com thriller, maybe. And I went ahead and watched the second episode last night. Did you happen to catch the second episode?
I didn't. I was just so hyped on Jordan Excellence that I called it a night after that.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you. I think that, but we'll talk about the first episode. So if you haven't seen it, we're going to spoil that. We won't spoil the second episode, even though it's aired. Calling it a rom-com doesn't feel right to me, though.
No, it does have maybe the atmosphere of one on one level, but there's also something a little, I agree with that thriller take. Like there's something kind of lurking the whole time, even, you know, when she got the text sitting in the parking lot. I guess we should run down the premise if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, do so. Or,
and we'll try to keep it light. A woman is sitting in the parking lot of like a Target or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And just suburbia malaise, you know, a billion other SUVs on either side. She gets this text that just says, run, all caps.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of freaks out and tries to figure out what to do. And she responds, run. And then she tries to open her door. Slams it into the one next to her, gets out and kind of walks around the parking lot, finally gets back in her car, peels out, away she goes. So you're thinking like, is there like a pursuit that's about to happen or killers on their way, that kind of thing? No, no, they're not. But it was a strange setup. And, even once things kept moving, there are details that are intentionally not being shared. You just wonder what's going on. But so she goes to meet her her college flame, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Flies from California to New York, gets the first train after five, like they had said that they would do 15 years before, from Grand Central, and they start out towards Chicago on this train. And that's pretty much it. They haven't spoken in years and years and years.
And the she is Ruby, played by Merritt Weaver, and the he is Billy, played by Domhnall Gleeson. Both really good actors, excuse me. And the first episode really had me from the get-go. That first image is so striking because I think the first image is the bird's eye view of all these SUVs and mom minivans, right? Yeah.
Soccer mom. That reminded me of like the first season of Weeds in a way.
Yeah, I can see that.
Watch Weed, just like the plastic California kind of, and not that it's geographically centered, but yeah, just the bullshit.
Yeah, the humdrum of the mundane existence that some of us, including me, you know, live. But I'm okay with mine, actually. I actually love mine. So I tell you another thing I loved. I love this almost non-existent amount of exposition because there are shows, and I'm going to compare it to Westworld in a weird kind of way here. There are shows like Westworld who insist on giving you no exposition and then are like nudging you to go figure it out on your own, or we're going to hold this back until the last episode. That's not what's happening on this show. It's non-existent amount of exposition because you don't need it.
Yeah.
And but they're going to dole it out. You know, they're going to give it to you maybe in episode 2, 3, 4, but right now you don't need it to be invested in these characters and figure out what happens next or to be on board on what happens next.
No. And I think the amount of details that they give, like you, by the time you realize that they're old college lovers or whatever the background is, you know, immediately you think, why did they split up? What are they doing now? Who do they have that they're leaving behind? Because you see her husband or significant other, they don't really reveal that for a bit, freaking out and saying, I'm going to call the police. And she can't get, so this was such a familiar thing from being on tour, like her walking up and down the train, trying to get service somewhere, and then like running outside to get above and chasing that signal and then trying to get back on the train.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we figure out that he is a like a motivational speaker of sorts, or right, a writer. So she knows that about him. He doesn't know what she does for a living or where she lives, anything like that. And she's not willing to divulge all of that information. She just says she works at an architecture firm, right?
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't even say where. So they're doling out the information to each other. And I'm with you that they're not... Restricting that is kind of fun, but it's not hindering the story in any way.
Oh, no, not at all. Merritt Weaver is just a delight in everything I see her in, actually. She was in Unbelievable, which I talked about with Donovan on the podcast a few months ago when it was on Netflix. And Domhnall Gleeson, he's great. I've never seen him be a bad actor. So yeah. You get your two, and they're really the focus. We haven't added any additional characters yet, but one character I imagine we're going to get is her husband, Lawrence, who is played by, his name slips my mind, but he's Harry from Mad Men. And I know you got thoughts on that.
Harry. Ugh, Harry. That guy, I don't know. Are we going to fall into a Mad Men discussion now? Because the arc of Harry, I feel so bad for this guy.
Harry Crane. Summer is the actor's name. I just want to give him credit there because he is a pretty good actor, but he's sort of infamous now for playing the disgruntled, the cuckolded husband, the nerdy husband who's left in the wake of a wife doing this or that.
But he turns into just such a bag of crap on Mad Men. You know, he starts out...
Oh, he's a goober. Absolutely.
But he's like trying to like sleep with Megan at the end and all this kind of stuff.
Which says nothing about his character on this particular show. Because
I don't know.
Well, right. She obviously had a reason to say, fuck it, I'm running.
If he's, that appeared to me to be, if somebody was like, do you want to do something drastic? And the parking lot of a Target would be the time to get me to sign up. You know what I mean? And then realize that, oh, I've caused collateral damage. I need to bail. I probably wouldn't have gotten on the plane, but just the desire to flee from that parking lot. I get it.
Yeah.
But who knows? Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm not going to reveal, you know, anything spoiler wise beyond episode one, but any intuitive viewer would know that there's more going on and there's more to be added, right?
Yeah, they've got to flesh out the backstories and decide where they're going. I mean, they both, I texted you when I watched it. The tension is so real between them that they had to individually go into the bathroom unbeknownst to the other and maybe burn off a little of that energy.
We'll be polite, won't we?
Yeah, that's it was an interesting choice for the premiere episode of a new program.
But and hilarious.
Very funny.
And I'll say the good news for any viewer, and good news for you, is that episode two gets funnier.
Can't wait.
Yeah. So let's take a break, and we're going to come back. And after, when we come back, we're going to talk about the Devs finale and maybe touch on I'm Not Okay With This just a little. And I want to talk about the challenge a little. And there's a reason why.
It was a big one.
And that's why. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a break here, and we're going to hear from our sponsors. I'm kidding. We don't have sponsors, but we are going to take a break. Yet. Hey, folks, Taking It Down's now a weekly podcast for the time being, and we are part of the Alabama Take Network of Podcasts, all of which you can find on the website, thealabamatake.com, or subscribe to us on your favorite podcast provider. That way, you won't miss a single episode, okay? In a separate feed, you can also search and find The Alabama Take. That is a podcast unto itself. Our one and only Corey Hanna sits with musicians, authors, artistic tots. He does an excellent job of digging into each of their stories. That show is currently on a season break, but it gives you plenty of time to catch up. One of my personal favorites, honestly, is the one with Sweet Dog. And even if you don't know Sweet Dog or have ever heard of him, that episode is worth every minute. So check out the Alabama Take podcast, subscribe to both of our podcasts, review, like, press that heart button on the podcast, and follow us on social media so that you are always up to date. Let's get back into our show. Okay, so we are back, and we're going to talk that finale of Devs. This one, we could spend a whole podcast episode on. I guess we won't, but what did you think? Where do we start with this one?
I guess I'll start by saying that a show that's as ambitious as this, they could have really missed the landing. And I don't think they stuck it as well as maybe they could have. But when you open up, I mean, the show is about a million worlds of possibility. And that kind of reflects how you end an 8-episode run. The one that they landed on was not so bad, I don't think. It was pretty true to the story and the characters, I felt like. I don't know. I always struggle to, you know, after the great True Detective burning of 2014. I always temper expectations going into the last episode, but I thought it was pretty solid. What did you think? We haven't really discussed this that much on text, so I'm very interested to see what you have to say.
You're hesitant to say that it was good, though. What's holding you back?
I think it opened really strong. I think of the episode as having two halves. You know, there's the
it did, yeah.
The build-up, we're assuming that you've seen the episode if you're listening now, the build-up to the event on the more or less elevator.
Yeah, whatever that thing is.
Right, so the before and after of that. And I think before it was pretty strong, and then after is when you can maybe start to poke holes in what went down. I don't know. At the same time, what happened after felt true to character. Especially Lily was kind of just drug along into it, and we don't really see her reaction to it. But Forrest, it makes everything that he did, all his motivations up until then, make sense. So it checked out there. I think maybe people, you know how it is. You spend a lot of time, emotional investment in something, and it's a show that makes you think, and you come up with all these fanciful ways that it could wrap up. Like there was theories that maybe there are multiple universes going on, and the event that they can't see past is the true lily, you know, at the, if you think of it like a Inception kind of thing, the lily at the top of the pyramid of truth or reality or whatever, somehow defeats Forrest, keeps them from doing this thing and shuts devs down. And that's why it all shuts down. But instead, that's not reality. We are led to believe is what we saw, you know, that there, mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess that's the whole question in the determinism versus free will.
I was a little shaky on how they got into the system. Like, I understand that that was Forrest's goal, that for everything to end so that he could enter the system and be in a simulation where he is, where it felt real and he's always with his family.
Right.
So how did they get there, you know?
Just like the mechanics of like the thumb drive of their brain being inserted into the USB.
I guess. And that's not anything that has to be answered because I'm certainly fine with it not. But I was just like, he shows up on the screen and he says, where am I? And she says, you're in the system now. So, okay, how?
Yeah, yeah. I've seen people online say that they are dead. Forrest and Lily are dead.
Right, yeah.
But the idea is that, I don't know, maybe his refusal to, I can't remember the specific issue, but, you know, Lily is saying, like, it's not real, and he has totally lost grasp. I guess it depends on your perspective. You could say he's lost a grasp on what real is, or he has evolved in his understanding of what real is. So depending on your perspective on that, Lily thinks that the material world that they're in is reality, and he's willing to say that his daughter, Amaya, on that screen is just as real as what he's experiencing. So I don't know if he's willing to die. Like, I don't know. If it wasn't like they like scooped his brains up and made it like inserted that into that new reality, right?
That's what's got me. That's the only thing that's got me with the finale.
There are multiple, and I don't know why he did this. The versions that other people, other hymns had to endure that were everything from hellacious to just okay to they live mm-hmm. in paradise, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but they also live in all of those places because a different them had to go to each of them. I don't understand why he did that.
Yeah.
Maybe to go because the theory had to be true that there had to be a multiverse. I don't know.
I think it was unavoidable, right?
I guess so.
And I was on board with that. That idea that, yeah, there's another version of him that's just living in hell, and there's another hell, you know, in quotation marks, and there's another version that's living just a very meh existence, and then there's a version of him that's there in the field with his wife and daughter once again. I like that part.
Was very consistent with his character, I thought.
Yes.
And also it makes sense why he gets just furious at the beginning or towards the beginning of the season when he says, if one hair is off on her head, it's not her. Mm-hmm. Because he didn't want multiple options. Because if one hair is off, then 20 can be off, then mm-hmm. 2000. And so it slowly becomes not the reality that he's trying to get to.
Right.
And I thought for the longest that he was trying to resurrect her in some way, which I guess he was, but it wasn't in any way that we could understand.
Right. Right. So, which made me fine with the ending. I thought it was a good ending. I thought the show wasn't hindered by the ending. Everything was good for me. Just as a viewer, I did think that if it would have been anyone other than Nick Offerman playing Forrest, he was the true MVP. I think that
absolutely.
I think the writing and the concept of the show was absolutely great. Alex Garland, yes, mm-hmm. I almost said yeah. Alex Gibney. Alex Garland did a great job. With everything, I think, directing, writing, but Nick Offerman sealed the deal because I could see him being cold-hearted in trying to get what he wanted, yet have the humanity and the emotion to cry when he would watch Amaya on that screen.
Yeah, or maybe the most on-the-nose one was his actions and choices led to Jamie having his hand broken and being tortured and then eventually killed. And he's remorseful when he finds all of those things over the course of not remorseful because of the actions, but he's sorry that he caused harm to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I thought Allison Pill was great as well. She was made a great, she wasn't a sidekick. I mean, a lesser performance may have relegated it to that, but I thought she was really strong playing kind of the brains of Devs.
And she's good in that kind of performance, that sort of cold performance I've seen her do before. And that's kind of in her wheelhouse for sure. The show seems to land on everything being predetermined, right? Because there was Lily throws the gun out of the little elevator thing, but yet they still crash and die because Stuart was going to be the one behind it.
Stuart ends up being the maybe one of the more interesting characters on the show because, you know, he's always kind of reminding Forrest and the others that they don't understand human history. And we've talked about this, like the history of humanity itself, not like a sequence of events.
Right, which is alluded to in that episode where he's quoting the Philip Roth poem that we've talked about.
Right. So, you know, I've seen it theorized.
Philip Larkin. Man, I'm getting all my names confused today. It's okay.
It's okay. This is, we're covering a lot of ground today. We're moving quick.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen it theorized that he was afraid what would happen with this machine in the hands of Forrest. Like if Forrest had been, even though Forrest wanted to die in that elevator, no matter what, he was still, Stuart was afraid of any manipulation that could happen there. And he may have thought that there was no way for Allison Pill's character to get out once that elevator crashed. He may have thought that Devs could just, you know, the idea of humanity going prior to the 20th century, people would like, there was restricted information, right? You know, like the Catholic Church would like hide information away if it got too advanced and dangerous, you know, quote unquote dangerous for our minds. And Stuart, I don't know if he's making a similar choice here because he doesn't believe that they have the necessary grasp on human nature to introduce a machine like this. Or maybe he just wanted to kill Stuart, or maybe he knew that, or not kill, so kill Forrest, sorry, that Lily's decision didn't matter because the ultimate deterministic act was him killing them. Maybe he was just staying on the train, on the tracks. I don't know.
I'll theorize that I think Stuart did it because he was worried they were going to tell others that he was watching Marilyn Monroe and Arthur Miller have sex.
So he's not a hero for that.
He didn't want it out. He didn't want that stuff out.
Yeah. My only other issue with the ending was the idea of Forrest just saying, Lily, you're just special. You know, we couldn't have planned for you in our understanding of determinism. Like her choice to throw the gun away shocks them, right? Even though the same result is achieved. So there's principles that dictate this whole universe that they live in, but she was the exception to it, you know? Like that doesn't quite square up to me.
It didn't seem clear.
I didn't get it, and I didn't appreciate the explanation that she was just unique. You know, like they keep saying that through the whole and she is. I mean, a less resolute person would have just given up when they realized that they were dealing with, you know, ambitious people who would murder to achieve their ends. So she has shown herself to be exceptional over the course of the season, but not like above the laws of the universe that they've based this machine that works on.
Yeah, that seemed a bit shaky, but otherwise I think the show was good. And did you find it stupid or dumb that Forrest reveals the show is actually Deus and not Devs?
No, I thought that was fine.
Yeah, I did too. But it does have this cool little thing, this cool meta thing with Alex Garland being mm-hmm. the author of a movie, Ex Machina, and a show, Deus.
So. Yeah, I thought that was great. I mean, Nick Offerman played that scene and the one where they're in the elevator and he says something about, you know, what messiahs do. Or something like that. They come back to that stuff was so creepy. When in his, you know, you're kind of like trying to figure out what's his end game, what's he up to. I don't know. That was I'm circling back around to you saying how good his performance was, but it really tied it all together for me.
It did. And if you watch the show for nothing else than seeing Nick Offerman sort of stretches acting ability, stretches chops, I think that's worth it. It's a very good performance by him. And it turned out it was a pretty good show too.
Yeah, this one, I would strongly recommend this one to anybody.
My wife, and I did too, I'll say this, I agreed with her, but she found it incredibly sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's profoundly sad. The whole thing is based on tragedy after tragedy. They are like the compelling, inciting events, right?
Right, exactly. Let's shift into another ending. Did you and your house get a chance to finish I'm Not Okay With This?
We did.
Good.
Because they're 20-minute episodes. So, we sat down with dinner and it was over before we knew it.
Exactly. And there were only seven of those. Mm-hmm. So I thought we would, let's do a quick series of thoughts on how we felt about this one. and I'll give it a start here. So I found it to be a pretty solid show and one I was absolutely fine with not completing its narrative. It really did set up a second season with the final episode.
But absolutely.
I found myself okay with that rather than being disgruntled and saying, oh, you know, wrap it up and then do something different in season two. How did you feel?
There was a moment when I realized that, one, the last episode came on the screen. I didn't realize we were on the last episode because it was just in that autoplay zone on Netflix. And the episode was 24 minutes long. And I thought, oh, no, is this the last episode? And then they start mentioning going to the homecoming dance. And I'm like, yep, gotta be. This has gotta be the finale, is at the big dance. So, and I'm with you. It ended and I wanted more.
Yeah, I did too. But I felt like this felt like an opening chapter or two, opening few chapters to a book that they're going to, you know, get around to finishing. I do think that the show leaned too heavily on Stephen King's Carrie and Stranger Things and The End of the Fucking World, which makes sense because it's written for TV by the same guy and written in a graphic novel form by the same guy, two different guys. It leaned heavily on John Hughes films like The Breakfast Club, and it modernized some of those, I felt, but it kind of relied too much on those kinds of things, I felt, to be an excellent show, but it sure was a lot of fun to watch.
So I read an interview with the guys behind the showrunners, and they said that they were aware of The Breakfast Club. That was kind of an open thing, but the Carrie thing, they hadn't even thought of that until they saw a poster that Netflix made for the show.
Yeah, totally mirrored the posters you see for Carrie.
But it just insane to me that they talked about that because one of the guys worked on Stranger Things as well. It's like, you know, the Duffer brothers, right? That's their name. They don't sit there and like study, say, framing for these old 80s movies that are their inspiration. It's just that it's so saturated into their approach and their consciousness and what they're into that's what comes out. So, and, you know, they didn't like block anything off to be a Carrie tribute or a tribute to anything else. So I think they were pretty conscious when they had the episode where they're all locked into the school. It's going to be, how could it not be a little Breakfast Clubby at that point?
Sure.
I thought the whole thing was great. That didn't really bug me. It had the most to do for me. And again, you already touched on this. It's because it's the same authorship from page to screen with The End of the Fucking World. Just in the vibe of it. I loved it. I thought it was great.
So, spoiler for the graphic novel. If I'm not mistaken, the graphic novel ends with her going to that fire tower and causing her own head to explode, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Am I correct on that?
That's what I read, that she meets her end that way, and they gave it to the jock character instead. I forget his name.
Brad. I think I called him Josh in a previous podcast.
Freaking Brad. That was great. You don't always want to see somebody's head explode, but I found that very gratifying.
I did too, and kind of funny at the same time.
Just the sheer in the graphic novel,
she's the one. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So she ends up doing that to herself. What this does, of course, is blatantly sets up a second season. But I felt myself being, you know, if I can borrow the phrase, okay with this. You know, I was fine because that mysterious figure that seems to be able to appear, disappear, we don't know anything about. One key thing, I guess, is that she didn't recognize him, so it probably isn't her dad.
Which is what I thought for the whole, once the shadowy figure was introduced, so like, oh, it's her dad. She got her powers from her dad somehow, and now, which that did seem to be confirmed, that she's only noticed these things after his passage. But I don't know if that, it may not be as mechanical. That feels very Stephen King, like, oh, he got her powers after, or she got his powers after his death. It may be more just a response to great loss or, you know, emotional turmoil. I don't know. It doesn't really seem to matter. Now she's got him.
That's right. Yeah. And I do, I don't know. I've got one last thing I'll say. I do recommend it. It's good. It's short. It's, there's, you know, there's not a lot of really wrong with the show. I do like that it kind of morphed, or became a comment on a reckoning of being gay in a small town. I thought that was a nice modern twist to some of these things it's borrowing from.
Yeah. And I thought that they really did a nice job when Stan asked, does she know about you? And she says, she's not sure what Stan's talking about for a split second. They're sitting on the bleachers there at the dance. And I think that was the, you know, you don't want to, it could be about a bigger, her powers and trying to understand them could just be about adolescence, but it really tied it together there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. It's a good show. I recommend it if you like Stranger Things, and definitely if you like The End of the Fucking World, this show's for you. Which takes us into a show that's definitely for us.
For everyone.
For everyone, but definitely for you, me, and our writer on the website, T.D. Wood. So the challenge on MTV, we've got to talk about it. I kind of said in our previous podcast that we might be finished talking about the challenge because what we would do is let our writing speak for us. But CT was eliminated.
Oh, I feel like I finally got you back in, you know, to the challenge. I said, this is for in quarantine days. Now is the time to dive in. And you picked your guy, you picked your horse, you bet all your money, all your emotional investment went on CT, and I can't blame you one bit, because this modern era dad bod CT is just a lovable guy, and he's, you know, in text, I kind of went through his whole arc. You remembered him as this young agitator, and, you know, he went through this whole thing with getting kicked off the show a few times, disappearing for a while. You know, his brother was killed, and he came on the show shortly after that and was just a total disaster and almost killed people there. He dated Diem off and on. She lost a battle with cancer. You see a lot of that on screen. It's just a guy who's been through it over 20 years on MTV. A very, who could have predicted that would be the guy that you would kind of watch grow up, but we were all in on CT and now he's gone.
An amazing arc, and with Diem, he was by her side a lot of the time. She was going through such a rough patch of life.
Yeah, and the guy that he probably should have been banned for life for just beating the utter crap out of, his name was Adam, unfortunately, apparently a real creep to the girls on the show. So even the guy that he picked on, he has this... We're going to turn it into a CT love fest. I don't care. The way that he speaks to everybody in the house, especially the women, has, and I know there are instances where this was not true. Rivals too. He was particularly crude to a girl that he had hooked up with just a few nights earlier. But, you know, he seems more like the way he treated Cara Maria when she was kind of the, I know you missed a lot of those seasons, the underdog that everybody picked on. He was always respectful of her. Tends to not put people down unless they really deserve it. Like he'll call bananas out if he's being a hypocrite, do all these kind of things.
I said he punches up.
He does. He does. And that's an endearing quality. I will say the guy that took him out, and we talk about this in TD's post, we have our little confessional section to get whatever is on our minds out. Jay, the guy that took him out, may not be all that bad a competitor. I don't know how long he's going to last on a season where they're gunning for him, but they keep throwing him in because he's small. They think he's small, but I don't know. This dude's smart. You know, Jordan is fresh off of a string of wins. Well, not consecutive, but a lot of wins, and he's a smaller guy. I don't know. There's something to that. Also, CT not in the best shape. This is kind of like watching I'm trying to think of what pro athlete would you compare him to?
Like, and I compared him to like what was it, in about 91, 92, Larry Bird with the busted up back and
yeah,
still out there exactly. Trying his damnedest to play, but just doesn't have what he used to have.
And it's still at moments the best guy on the court, you know, like would have one of those kind of guys who's so close to retirement and you want him to win again so bad, even though CT has won recently. You're just, you know, you always want him to have a shot at it. It's like if you're a tennis fan, a completely opposite character, but Roger Federer is at the end of his career. And every time he gets close, it's just like, just win one more, just get one more, you know,
right.
He's banged up. He's not feeling good, but he'll have these moments of brilliance where you're like, oh yeah, that's him. And yes, I am comparing Roger Federer and Larry Bird to CT because he's at that level.
We could throw in Tiger Woods. Seems like an adequate comparison too.
Yeah, Tiger at the Masters last year.
Yeah, yeah.
Just get another one. You've been through it. You talk about a guy with an arc.
Yeah. So I was totally pulling for CT, and I'm petty. I'm petty as hell when it comes to sports. Like if you're the team that beat my favorite team, then I want you to get crushed at whatever happens next. So do you think Jay is going to be put into any more purgatory?
No, I'll say on your point about how petty you are, we talk crap about Johnny Manziel still like once a week. So we're a spiteful group.
We totally are. I think in sports it's okay.
Yeah, it's part of the fun. I wonder what's going to happen with the skulls, because they keep giving him more, which is interesting. It's not just like you have one, it mm-hmm. keeps getting more. So maybe that means that he has to have no skulls to get eliminated. Maybe he could lose an elimination and stay, like somebody else would steal his skull. Or maybe when he's leaving, he could give the skull away. Because I mean, theoretically, let's say they throw him again this week. Well, it was the girls this week. The next opportunity that they have, they throw him in. He wins again. He has three of the skulls. If he just goes away, do those three skulls go with him? Which yeah. means that through cowardice, three of the guys have eliminated themselves.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I don't know. We'll find out, though, and I'm definitely not pulling for him. Our buddy and fellow podcaster, Corey Hanna, is all about Jay. He's pulling for him.
He's in. He's impressed.
Not me.
Not you. So who's your guy?
I'm impressed, but I'm not pulling for him.
If you had to pick a guy and a girl, who are you going with?
Okay, so Melissa's my girl because, I don't know, she's just incredible.
She's got that the big dragon energy, yeah. The Daenerys kind of vibe.
Yeah, she's got that the Daenerys vibe going. That's a big, huge thing. So she's my gal. I haven't settled on a guy. I'm okay with Corey. I'm kind of okay with Fessy. I don't like Rogan, but I do kind of want him to get his revenge on Jay, sort of, because of CT.
Oh, Rogan's terrible, though.
He is terrible, but at the same time, I kind of... But you know what? Wes is kind of growing on me. He's old school, and because of his... He's not relatable, but because I've seen him enough, I kind of lean toward Wes.
Things happen to Wes that... To me, he's like he's not, but later day Wes is like a Pete Campbell kind of character. You don't want to admit that maybe you're more like Wes in a situation than you are like a CT or Bananas, but a lot of the time you're kind of the Wes.
Agreed. So for listeners, we may not talk about the challenge. I don't know. You can't ever tell. It's week to week for us because huge things could very well happen, but... For more coverage on this, our original taker, Mr. T.D. Wood, he's going to have a Thursday column running every Thursday where he'll talk about the challenge. And Adam and I get the pleasure of writing up a confessional based on the previous episode. So you can find a lot more of our thoughts there. if you want to keep up with those. So anything else you wanted to say?
Oh, we covered so much ground. I mean, we could have, honestly, after that challenge, I could have done a 90-minute episode just on that, breaking it down. But yeah. So we did pretty good to cover as much ground as we did. So I'll relinquish now.
Oh, yeah, we did. And I sort of promised social media that we would give a heads up on what we were covering. But honestly, it was a last minute decision. And as you can see, we couldn't narrow anything down. So maybe for next week, I'll post on social media going into the weekend what we're going to talk about. So
we didn't even touch on Plot Against America. That's no, heating up. So we'll double down next week.
Right, because I think the last episode of that will air tonight. So we'll discuss it as a whole.
Perfect.
Yeah. So anyway, that is it for this week. People, we hope you enjoyed it. Please subscribe to us and listen to us. Rate us, review us. We'll be back next Tuesday, and we'll let you know what we plan on watching. I think we'll try to get into that habit of giving you a heads up. And that's it for Taking It Down. See you all soon.